As they are going up, if you can open up in your Bibles, please, to Galatians chapter 3. Galatians chapter 3. We will be continuing in our study of the book of Galatians. Galatians chapter 3, and as will be no surprise to any of you who've been here as we've been going through the study, Paul will be continuing to talk about the blessing of faith and comparing and contrasting faith and law today. Galatians chapter 3, you can read along up here. I'll be reading in the New International Version. We're going to look at Galatians 3, 15 through 25. Hear the word of the living God. Brothers, let me take an example from everyday life. Just as no one can set aside or add to a human covenant that has been duly established, so it is in this case. The promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. The scripture does not say, and to seeds, meaning many people, but and to your seed, meaning one person who is Christ. What I mean is this. The law introduced 430 years later does not set aside the covenant previously established by God and thus do away with the promise. For if the inheritance depends on the law, then it no longer depends on a promise. But God in his grace gave it to Abraham through a promise. What then was the purpose of the law? It was added because of transgressions until the seed to whom the promise referred had come. The law was put into effect through angels by a mediator. A mediator, however, does not represent just one party, but God is one. Is the law therefore opposed to the promises of God? Absolutely not. For if a law had been given that could impart life, then righteousness would certainly have come by the law. But the scripture declares that the whole world is a prisoner of sin, so that what was promised being given through faith in Jesus Christ might be given to those who believe. Before this faith came, we were held prisoners by the law, locked up until faith should be revealed. So the law was put in charge to lead us to Christ that we might be justified by faith. Now that faith has come, we are no longer under the supervision of the law. The other night with a couple of my kids, we had on TV, we were flicking around, and they were doing a championship from America's Funniest Videos. And one of the things that caught my attention was a mom was trying to videotape her young daughter singing, and there was a young brother in the video, and he was supposed to be kind of in the background. But the longer the video went, the more the little boy was out taking all the attention away from the sister. She was trying to sing, and he's dancing around and pointing and doing things, and all the attention is going to the little boy. And I thought, you know, the sister's probably wanting to choke the little boy right now because his purpose was to be in the background. But instead, he was trying to get up in the forefront, and he was messing up everything. That was kind of cute and funny, because he was only like a little 2 or 3 year old kid. But how many of you have ever seen something like that happen where something that's supposed to be in the background starts to dominate and it starts to mess everything up? What if, for example, if you can imagine here, this is going to take some real imagination, let's say I was a professional singer. Or better yet, let's say Renee was a professional singer. Renee or Jill are up and they're singing a duet and I'm supposed to be in the background doing the little oohs and ahs in the background. But as the song goes along, I said use some imagination. I took the microphone away and I start singing very loudly and I start drowning them out. Am I accomplishing my purpose? No, that's right, yeah. I'm driving them crazy. See, I not only am messing up what they're doing, I'm completely messing up what I was meant to do. Now, I bring that analogy up because Paul today is going to be continuing. This is in some ways a transitional section, but he's continuing to develop this idea of what's the proper role and function of the law, what's the law's place as compared to faith. And the analogy that I'm using here is law was always meant to be, as it were, a backup singer. It was never the main artist. It was never meant to be the focus. And Paul today gives us multiple reasons why the law is inferior to the promise, why the law cannot match God's covenant promise that is received by faith. It's the same message we've seen over and over in the book of Galatians. So we're going to look at this today, and Paul's going to give us 4 reasons why the law is inferior, or you could flip it around and say why the promise is superior, and he's trying to, again, convince the Galatians, You don't want to give up faith and go back to law. So four reasons. Let's look at them. First, Paul says the law is inferior because it came after the promise. What came first is superior and outlasts what came later. And what came first was the promise, and then the law came. He begins doing this in verse 15 with a human analogy. He says, brothers, let me take an example from everyday life. Just as no one can set aside or add to a human covenant. Now, you notice here the word human covenant. This is difficult. Some of your translations may say a will and testament. And this is because of the word that's behind it, which is diatheke. There's a couple of possible ways you could translate this word. First, diatheke, Jeremy, you can go to the next screen, can mean will or testament. This was the way it was normally used in Greek. If you lived in Athens, say 100 years before the time of Christ, and had gone down to have a will and testament drawn up, you were having a diatheke drawn up. That was a last will and testament. And so if Paul was using the term to mean that here, it would mean you can't change the will after the person dies. When it's put into effect, if I have a will and I leave certain things in my will, nobody else can come in and change it after it's been put in effect. Paul would be making that sort of analogy. Or he might be saying no one else can change that person's will. What he's dealing with here is the unilateral nature of a diatheke, that when it's been established, nobody else can change it. The other possibility, however, is that Paul means it to be the way the NIV translated it, which is the term covenant. The reason that it might mean that is how it was used in the Old Testament. When the Old Testament was translated into Greek, they had a little bit of a problem. There are two Greek words that could have been used. One of them was diatheke, which usually meant last will and testament. The other one was the one, if I was making an agreement with John Wyman, if we were signing a contract, the word that was usually used was suntheke. But they didn't like that word because that word carried the idea soon, that preposition soon, or that prefix soon, means it's two equals making an agreement. When God cuts covenant with humanity, is that two equals making an agreement? Not at all. So they said, well, we can't call it suntheke because that would give the idea that God's our equal somehow. So they went and they took the other word, diatheke, and they said, well, that's usually used for a last will and testament, but at least it's one person imposing a will on another, and that's more what God's covenant is. He dictates the terms. So that's how it was used in the Old Testament, and in fact, almost every time it's used in the New Testament, that's the way the term is used. When we hear of a new covenant, the term is diatheke. All through, in fact, in verse 17, when he refers to God's covenant with Abraham, it's diatheke. If that's what he means here, he's saying you can't change the essence of a covenant. When a covenant has been cut between two persons, you can't arbitrarily come in and start changing, especially not anything that would be the essence of the covenant. Or he could be meaning that one person or someone else can't change the covenant. But the key idea here, I really think covenant is more the idea. And if I were translating it, not that anybody's ever going to ask me, but if I were, I would use the word covenant. But the real idea, the key idea is that you can't change the essence of a binding legal agreement. And we can all understand this. Paul's making a common sense argument. If I made a deal with John that he was going to come do some work for me at my house or somewhere else, we can't partway through start changing all the ideas that were inherent in the contract. And I decide I'm going to pay him less than what I had said I was going to pay him, or he's going to do less work. You can't start doing that. That violates a binding legal agreement. And Paul's saying, that's the way human relationships work, and that's the way, in fact, it works when God has entered into this binding legal agreement with us, his covenant with us. And the point that Paul is getting at then is, what is the first thing God established? The promise or the law? Which was established first? The promise. And therefore, Paul says in verse 17, notice here, the law introduced 430 years later. Notice what Paul is saying there is, the law came, and not just a day or two later, 430 years later, the law came. Abraham lived the rest of his life. His descendants are living there in Canaan. They then go down to Egypt. They live in Egypt 400 years, and then the law, they get delivered from Egypt, and then the law comes. And Paul says, you can't go changing the binding legal agreement 430 years after the covenant was made. Paul's saying that would not be possible. And in fact, what he's getting at then is that the law cannot change the promise. Notice also in verse 17, it does not set aside the covenant or do away with the promise. Now, the reason for this is because, if you remember, is the law based on promise? Are they the same thing? See, these are two different agreements. They're not based on the same thing. We won't turn there right now, but in Galatians 3:12, if you remember, Paul says clearly, the law is not based on faith. On the contrary, the man who does these things will live by them. But the righteousness that comes by faith, Paul says the just will live by faith. They are two opposing principles. So what Paul is saying here is the promise came first, and you can't say, well, the law came in and it was basically the same thing. Paul says, no, they're not. They're exact opposites. They are not the same thing. And if you're going to maintain that then the law came in and replaced the promise, you're saying God has violated his covenant oath. Paul says God does not do that any more than human beings do that. You cannot change it. Therefore, the law is inferior to the promise. The promise came first, and it dictates the nature of the relationship, and the law has to be understood in relation to promise, not promise in relation to law. Second thing that Paul goes on to say is the law is inferior because it was given through intermediaries. Now, this is a difficult section in this passage, okay? But I'm going to try and unpack what I think Paul is saying. Notice in verse 19, he says the law was put into effect through angels. Through angels. Now, this is an unusual phrase he uses here. We won't turn there, but if you remember in Acts chapter 7, verse 53, Stephen making his speech to the Sanhedrin when Saul, later Paul, is sitting there, Stephen makes the same statement. And in fact, this statement was very common in Judaism at the time. It's not really directly stated in the Old Testament. There is a passage in Deuteronomy 33, I believe it's verse 2, and in Psalm 68, verses 17 and 18, there are references that the rabbis developed and said that the angels were involved in the giving of the law. And so Paul here is quoting what is the common understanding that when God gave the law to Israel, the angels were involved in the giving of the law. So he says the law was put into effect through angels. But notice what he also says in verse 19, the law was put into effect through angels by a mediator. By a mediator. The literal phrase there is by the hand of a mediator. The reason Paul uses the phrase by the hand of, I think, is I believe the mediator, who's the mediator that took the law for Israel? It's Moses took the law. And in fact, if you read in the Old Testament, over and over and over again, we read by the hand of Moses, by the hand of Moses, by the hand of Moses. Usually our English translations don't keep that phrase because it sounds so odd to us. We just say by Moses. But the literal rendering in both the Hebrew and the Greek was by the hand of Moses. And so Paul here kind of keeps that terminology and says, it was put into effect through angels by the hand of a mediator who is Moses. Now, why is Paul bringing this up? He then, in verse 20, notice the statement that he makes here. He says, the law is put into effect through angels by a mediator. A mediator, however, does not represent just one party, but God is one. Now, he is certainly making reference to the fact when he says God is one, what is anybody who's familiar with the law going to immediately think of? The Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. We just read that a few moments ago in our baby dedication. So, he knows they're going to do that, and he's saying that's the essence of who God is the unity of God. God is one. And he's saying, but however, when you get involved with the mediator, whenever you have a mediator, if I tell you there's going to be a mediator, then what do you immediately know about what's going on here? How many parties are there at least? Well, there's at least, I mean, there's two parties involved plus a mediator in the middle between them. So whether you want to count the mediator as a party or not, but you at least know there's somebody getting in between. And in fact, what we have is if John and I are having this relationship and we now need Paul to be a mediator between us, there's starting to be distance between John and I. And what he is saying here by saying God is one is he's saying, look, the promise didn't have a mediator. When God made a covenant promise with Abraham, who was involved? Nobody. That was it. God came and spoke to Abraham. If you remember, he did it in Genesis 12. There's no mediator. In Genesis 15, which is the verse that Paul's been talking about, Abram believed God and it was credited as righteousness. There was nobody else involved. The Lord spoke. Later in Genesis 15, God puts Abram into a deep sleep, and you remember, the pieces are split apart, and who even walks between the pieces? Only God does. Not even Abram does. It's just God is involved in making this covenant. In Genesis 17, in the covenant with Abraham, there is no mediator involved. Every time God makes promise with Abraham, there is no mediator. And Paul is saying that is superior because that lines up with the nature of God. God is one. There's a unity within God, and he wants direct relationship. He does not want mediators. So consider this graphic here of what Paul is trying to get at. The law, it begins with, you have God who's involved with angels, who are involved with Moses, and finally, who gets the law on the other end? Israel. There's multiple layers between Israel and God under law. But when you consider the promise, we have God directly to Abraham. Can you see what Paul's saying? The promise is superior. The law's got all of these mediators between the people receiving the law and God. But when God makes promise, he makes it directly with the heir of the promise. The heir here being Abraham. We're going to see next week, I'm going to develop this, who ultimately was the Abrahamic covenant made with. Okay, if you're reading the Old Testament, who should you always see? Christ. Who does he say ultimately the seed of Abraham is? Christ. Ultimately, the promise was made with Christ, and there is no mediator. It is the Father making a covenant with the Son, of which Abraham gets to be a co-heir. Now, that's the first two reasons then. The law came after the promise. Paul says we already had the promise. We've been operating for 430 years. You can't stick a law in that changes the covenant. Secondly, Paul says, consider the covenant promise is a direct, unmediated promise. With the law, you get angels, you get Moses, and then finally you get the heirs of the law. Paul says this is not God's system. God's always wanted direct contact with his people. Thirdly, Paul says, the law is inferior because the law by its design only had limited purposes. Because if I were to say what I've said already, the promise came first, the promise was unmediated, what's the logical question regarding the law? Why have the law then? Why is the law even there? And Paul takes that up in verse 19. He says, what then was the purpose of the law? Why the law? It was added because of transgressions. Another difficult phrase. The theology in Galatians is pretty easy. Sometimes the Greek's a little tough to figure out what Paul's talking about. What does he mean by because of transgressions? There are three basic things that Paul could mean by this phrase. First, he could be saying because of transgressions. What he means by that is the law was given to reveal sin. Until Christ came, there needed to be something that was going to reveal sin to people. Consider Romans chapter 3, verse 20. A parallel passage where Paul talks about this. He says, through the law we become what? Conscious of sin. Paul says in that verse, just as we've been seeing in Galatians, the law was not given for us to become righteous. We were never going to be declared righteous before God by keeping the law, Paul says. But the law did have a purpose. What does the law do for me? Shows me my sin. So he could say because of transgressions, meaning that the law is showing me my sin. Romans 7:7 says the same thing. What then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. Indeed, I would not have known what sin was except through the law. Paul goes on there to talk about the 10th command, thou shalt not covet. And how does Paul say he knows that coveting was wrong? Because the law told him it was wrong. So it could be because of transgressions means that the law was given to reveal our sin. Paul teaches that elsewhere. It is certainly a key purpose of the law. Second possibility is that it could, in fact, have been given to provoke or increase our sin, to have us sin more. Does that sound odd to anybody here? It should sound odd to you, but that actually, see, when we think of law, we always think of law as doing what to us? Keeping us from sin. But that's not usually how Paul speaks of law. Consider these couple of verses in the book of Romans again. Romans 5:20. The law was added so that trespass might what? Increase. Not decrease, not keep us from sin. It might actually be more sin. And then he goes on and says, but where sin increased, grace increased all the more. This is Paul's analogy of being in Adam or being in Christ. Consider also in Romans chapter 7, verse 5. For when we were controlled by the sinful nature, the sinful passions aroused by the law were at work in our bodies. Does the law put to death our sinful nature, or does it arouse it? I invite you, take a young child, put a cookie jar in front of them, and tell them, do not get a cookie out of that jar. Who thinks that will make the child not want the cookie? Who in here is a parent knows that is not what it will make the child want to do. When we're told no, what do we immediately want to do? Okay? Adam, Eve, you can have any tree in the garden. You can eat any fruit you want. And where does Eve find herself in the next verse? Amazingly, standing next to the tree that she's not supposed to eat from. That's the way law works. Law tends to arouse our sinful passions, is what Paul teaches and says that. Now, let me say by purpose, is this because God likes sin? We were already sinners when the law came here. Why would God want to increase sin? To what? Oh. To make us aware again. See, it's because sin can't hide when it's just one or two little. I mean, sin might try to hide as one or two. What he says in Romans chapter 7 is, look, he's showing how wicked sin is. It's taking over everything. It's spreading. It's constantly growing. And God's doing that so that we know what's going on. It's kind of like if I have a sickness that stays hidden inside of me and there's no symptoms, do I go and try and find out what's wrong with me? When do I usually go to the doctor? When I start having symptoms that something's going wrong. And so Paul said, here's what God did. He gave the law to cause the sin to boil over so we would know what was going on. Because what's the outcome of both revealing sin and increasing sin? What do I look for then? Salvation from my sin. The third possibility that Paul could be talking about here is the covering of sin. Notice what he says. Next screen, Jeremy. It was added because of transgressions until the seed to whom the promise referred had come. Who is the seed that was talked about in the Abrahamic covenant? Jesus. If you say Isaac or Jacob, you're wrong. If you say the nation of Israel, you're wrong. That is not the seed referred to in the Abrahamic covenant. It is Jesus. Paul says so. Galatians 3, 16 and 19. But in the meantime, he's saying that we need somehow to deal with sin. The third thing that it might be talking about is, how did the Israelites, now that they know the law has revealed sin, it's in fact provoked sin, how do they deal with their sin? They atone for their sin, and what gave them the provisions to do that? The law. And how long did the law do that? Until the seed, the true sacrifice for sin, came. If you consider Romans 3:25, Paul says this. He says, God presented him as a sacrifice of atonement. He's speaking here of Christ. And he's saying Jesus fulfilled the sacrificial system. And notice why. Through faith in his what? He did this to demonstrate his justice because in his forbearance he had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. God had not committed sin because what he was doing was, did the blood of bulls and goats really take the sin away? No, but it was covering them, as it were, until the real sacrifice was offered. So Paul could mean any one of these three things. That the law was given to reveal sin, provoke or increase sin, or to cover sin. And in fact, in various places, Paul teaches all three of those things. It's probably even a conglomeration of the problem is that Paul's saying is, look, the promise is given, but the promise is not going to be fulfilled until who comes? Jesus. And in the meantime, we've still got to deal with sin. You need to understand you're a sinner. And you need to have a way to cover and atone for sin. And the law provides those things. I think the predominant thing here is to reveal sin. Do you and I seek salvation if we don't know our sin? Humanity does not. In fact, the huge problem he's dealing with in Galatia, what do human beings want to do before God? How do we want to be saved before God? By what? Our own work. The law causes us to despair of our own works Because the law, rather than reducing sin, increases sin. We get more trapped in sin, and it shows us that what we're doing is in fact sinful. And it pronounces a horrible curse upon us. And the outcome of that is it causes us to seek salvation. Not from the law, because we know that the law cannot provide that. Which is what Paul goes on to say in verse 21. Notice, this is the second purpose. It's given because of transgressions. It was not given to give life or righteousness. Paul's saying, look, the law is not opposed to the promise. Don't get an idea that they're fighting against each other. They're not opposed to one another because they weren't given for the same purpose. The promise was given to give you life. The law was never given to give you life. It is not its purpose. It is not its function. So he says here, if the law had been given that could impart life, then righteousness certainly would have come from the law. Notice how similar this sounds to a couple of verses we've looked at before. Galatians 2:21. What does Paul say there? I do not set aside the grace of God, for if righteousness could be gained through law, Christ died for nothing. Because if we could save ourselves by works, did Jesus need to die? Paul's saying the same thing again. He's coming back and pointing out, because law was never intended to do that. Also notice Galatians 3:11. Clearly no one is justified before God by law, because the righteous will live by faith. What takes you and I as dead to God and makes us alive to God? Is it our works or is it faith? What is it that takes us as wicked before God, deserving of condemnation for our own behavior, and makes us the very righteousness of God? Is it my works or is it faith? Faith. It's the same answer. And Paul's saying that's because the law was never intended. You remember the analogy I used a few weeks ago of the MRI. The MRI is a wonderful tool if you use it for what it's made for. But can it cure my disease? No. If I'm the backup singer, I'd be a good backup singer behind Renee and Jill, singing my doo-wops and up there. But what happens if I start grabbing the microphone and taking over the performance? Was I intended to do that? Never intended to do that. And Paul's saying, don't try and make the law do what it was never intended to do. It was never meant to give you life. It was never meant to make you righteous before God. That was not its purpose. In fact, Paul goes on to say, here's what the law's purpose was. It did have a positive purpose. Besides revealing and showing sin and not giving life, it had another purpose, which was it had a preparatory function. If you notice in verses 23 through 25, here, before faith came, we were held prisoners by the law, locked up until faith should be revealed. So the law was put in charge. That phrase there, put in charge, in the Greek, is paedagogos. Anybody want to make a guess what English word we try and get from paedagogos? Pedagogue. But there's a problem, and this is where you have to always be careful. Our English word pedagogue means what? Teacher. That is not what the Greek word meant. The Greek word for teacher is didaskalos. And in fact, we know not just from the Bible, Plato in his Republic wrote all about pedagogue. What a pedagogos did was they got a child ready for the teacher. They did not perform the instruction themselves. That was never the job of a pedagogos. They would not let them do it. A pedagogos was a slave. They worked for a rich, free family. They would take the children. They would get the child ready. They would discipline the child, train the child, get the child's books together, get the child dressed, get the child down, and then hand the child over to a didaskalos, a teacher,